So there's no comedy intro today. Not that I couldn't think of one. I could. I mean, I really even sort of thought about it, writing an intro where Captain Hook is, you know, being given a myoelectric hand or something like that. And then it struck me that that might be in bad taste. And not that that has always stopped us in the past, but we're doing a pretty serious show today about prosthetics and about the modern state of prosthetics. So I think it made sense to sort of, you know, and proceed forward in a very serious and sober fashion. We have some wonderful guests for you today, and we're going to introduce you to all of them right now. You know, in studio with me, actually, I should have checked pronunciation of last names. Michael Wininger, am I saying that right correctly?
Perfectly.
Okay, Michael Wininger is assistant professor, University of Hartford, and master's program in prosthetics and orthotics. In fact, before I go on to the other guests, you know, when we first started getting interested in this, it's partly because our friend Humphrey Tonkin had directed us to some stuff on the site there. And I suddenly wondered, how unusual is this program? How many programs across – I mean, does every – do lots of universities have programs like this one? Or?
I'm glad you brought up Humphrey. He's a great guy. Yeah. He's cool. And no, this is kind of a rarity. We are the closest program to the Hartford area. The nearest program is in Pittsburgh. There are somewhere, depending on your definition, between 9 and 11 programs that are accredited to award the terminal master's degree in prosthetics and orthotics.
Yeah, so that's already kind of a surprise for me that right in our backyard is this pretty unusual program. Also, in the studio with me is Robert Rodriguez. He is an amputee and plays basketball for AMP1, Freedom Innovations, the first stand-up basketball team. He just got off the court after a victory against who did you play today? You played people who don't have prosthetics, right?
Yes, sir. We played able-bodied players, a lot of PT students, and a few previous basketball players from Hartford.
And then joining us by studio connection, and I should have checked this last name pronunciation too, Rose Eveleth. Did I say that correctly?
Perfectly.
All right. Good Rose Eveleth, a science journalist and a columnist for BBC Future. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, along with including The Atlantic and Eon or Ion. I never know how to say it. We love that publication. We have people on all the time from there, and I've never learned how to say the name. She currently produces and hosts Meanwhile in the Future, a podcast for Gizmodo. Rose, I'm going to start with you because you and I are the, you know, people kind of we've learned about this from the outside. These folks are working at this from the inside. And so reading a lot of your reporting, I guess I got the education that you gave yourself. The way I thought about all of this was wrong. I had sort of two assumptions that were deeply, deeply flawed. One of them was who tends to constitute the marketplace for prosthetics, you know, where the need primarily comes from. And then sort of I think I had this picture that, you know, with all of these modern space-age materials and technologies, all kinds of problems had been solved in all kinds of marvelous ways, and the old problems were more or less gone. So neither one of those things is really true, but let's start with what you found out about who needs prosthetics. Where does the need come from?
Sure. So I think people who see prosthetics in the news a lot often think of veterans, they think of accident victims, they think of extreme athletes, and those are all people who absolutely use prosthetics. But the majority of people who are amputees actually come from cardiovascular disease or vascular diseases, things like diabetes and things that aren't quite as exciting maybe sometimes for the news, and they often sort of struggle in the background. And I've talked to a lot of people who are amputees due to those causes, and they sometimes feel a little bit left out by the media because they're not, you know, they're not veterans. They're not people who had some like really sort of exciting but tragic accident. And so most people, and I'm sure the other guests can talk about this too, most people who are amputees are not accident victims or veterans, which is the people that we see most often, I think, in the media at least.
And Michael, one thing that this does is also it must drastically affect sort of who needs what kind of prosthetic in the sense that Robert may want to get back on the basketball court as soon as possible. Somebody with a vascular disease may be looking for some other kind of performance or some other they may have lost the same limb but sort of need to be restored to some different kind of functioning.
Yes, and I think that Rose and I are probably kindred spirits in the sense that we're one of the few people who actually will recognize it as not just restoring function but also restoring aesthetics. And that so there's a whole branch of prosthetics which is essentially being ignored, which is that my prosthesis doesn't look like me. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like me, let alone how it functions. And I think that, yeah, I agree 100%.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember whether it was one of Rose's articles or not, but I read one where the person wanted his foot to look in a shoe the way his old foot looked in a shoe. In other words, he didn't want the shoe to bulge or be misshapen, or, you know, he wanted the foot, even though people wouldn't be looking at the foot, he wanted the shoe to look the way his shoe used to look, which makes a certain amount of sense.
We all deserve the right to be able to feel like our identity remains intact or can be restored. And if it doesn't look like you, doesn't feel like you, you may not identify with it as yours, and then you may not use it.
So, Robert, maybe it's a good time for you to tell your story. How is it that you entered this whole world of prosthetics?
When I was born, I had something called fibula hemimelia. I was born with two toes and missing an ankle. So about 10 months, my mother had to make a decision. I was either going to be in a wheelchair or she had to amputate my foot. And she made the best decision as far as amputation. Of course, this is back in the 80s, so technology wasn't where it is today.
So you basically, your whole life, you've needed prosthetics.
Yes, sir.
And this is another thing that I hadn't really thought about very much until I started reading about this. That meant over the course of your life, you've needed, as you've grown, as you've changed, you've needed to replace whatever prosthetic you had before, right?
Yes, sir. Usually on a yearly basis, especially as a child, you would probably have to get a new, I would have to get a new prosthesis about every year.
Yeah. And so, you know, Michael, maybe one thing that you can give us a little perspective on too is, so Robert's situation, I mean, one thing that I really did learn that I should be pretty obvious is everybody's really different, right? Every single human being is really different. And all of these stories are different. So Robert's story is radically different from somebody who, at the age of 42, for whatever reason, suddenly needs a prosthetic leg.
It's true. It's different, but it's also the same in the sense that, you know, Robert just described how he was 3 years old and needed prosthesis, and then he grew and he was 4 years old and needs new prosthesis, and then he's 5 and 6 and needs new prosthesis every year. Well, a 42-year-old man who is suddenly amputated and needs a new prosthesis is going to find an off-the-shelf prosthesis that just doesn't look like his and doesn't feel like his hand. And he'll have the same prosthesis that I might as a 34-year-old man who probably has a different hand shape and hand size, and we'll get the same prosthesis, and neither one of us will feel like this really is ours.
And so, Robert, I don't know. It must be a very difficult thing to describe to someone from the outside. But what for you are the most important aspects of having a prosthesis that works, that is what you need?
Day-to-day living. I'm a father of two, so keeping up with my children. As far as being an athlete, it's very important to have a good product under. Freedom Innovations is our AMP1 sole sponsor, so they give us a product where I'm able to get good energy return when I'm loading from my heel to my toe, so that this way I can go downstairs easier, go upstairs easier. I'm able to stay active and compete with others, as well as just go to work and live a day-to-day life, not having to worry about aches and pains in my back and my knees and things of that nature.
So you just used a couple of terms that I'm not necessarily familiar with. I think, was it energy return?
Yes, sir.
Explain what you mean by that.
So energy return, you need the shock value, let's say. You have, you know, if you're an able body or even in my left leg, where you have the shock value of your ankle and your heel, you need a good prosthetic foot so that this way you can walk in your day-to-day life and kind of feel that vibration loading from, you know, the ground up into your leg. So energy return, loading from the heel of the foot to the toe where you're experiencing some type of shock value.
We'll get into a little bit more of this as we go along here. We're all kind of getting educated together. If you have questions, we're live here in the afternoon. You can call at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You may also tweet us at WNPR Colin. So, Rose, as you looked at this landscape, I mean, I said this at the beginning. Maybe I was unbelievably naive, but I sort of thought, wow, probably all kinds of things are really fixed now. All kinds of problems have been solved because we're this incredibly competent society scientifically. And just, you know, I hadn't thought about prosthetics in many years other than, I mean, I know one person who has a prosthetic leg, but I hadn't thought about it a lot. And I was sort of surprised that in some ways somebody once wrote, we're still closer to Captain Hook than we are to the $6 million man. You want to react to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of things have gotten a lot better. I think outcomes for amputees in general has gotten a lot better. I think that sort of culturally also we've gotten a lot better at, you know, accepting people who are amputees and who use prosthetics that don't maybe look like their biological limb. So some people really want their hand or foot or whatever it is to look just like their sort of intact one. They wanted to have the same hair. And you can actually get these really fascinating sort of sleeves over things to look like it has hair and just to be really, really, really realistic. But there are also people who don't want that. There are these artists who work on these really beautiful but not at all biological looking limbs that some people are really into. Some people like the sort of mechanical look. So for a long time, I think that we were really, as a culture, kind of afraid of people who were embracing that sort of side, and we wanted people to hide it. And now we don't feel that way quite as much anymore. People are able to walk around with these prostheses and not feel like people are judging them. And so there are huge, we've made progress. It's not like we're still, you know, World War II level of prosthetics, but the human body is also really complicated and very unknown to us in a lot of ways. And it's not so easy to just make it again. You know, we're still figuring out how it works. And I think that, you know, people are getting better and it's getting better and there's a ton of advances that are happening and that's great. But I mean, what we do with our bodies is actually extremely amazing. And reproducing that is really hard. So there are definitely a lot of things that we still have to work on. And I think also just for amputees, and this is something we can talk about more, is everybody has different desires. So some people, you know, might want to play basketball, and that's awesome. And other people might just want to be able to, you know, move from their car to their home or whatever it is. Some people want to swim. Some people just want to be able to hold their kid's hand. That's maybe really the most important thing to them. And I mean, prosthetists, that they what they do is they listen to people and say, okay, this is what you want. I will try to make the very best version of that as I possibly can. And so I think there's really interesting ways that prosthetists do that with sort of both high and low tech objects. I think some of the ways that amputees hack their own prostheses sometimes to make things work for them and do things that they want is also really interesting. So we've definitely made progress. It's not like we're still, you know, on pirate ships. It's hard. It's really hard. It's really hard to do that.
Michael, I'm sure you have a lot of ways you want to react to that. I just want to sort of add by saying that reading Rose's work and reading some of the other stuff, I started to get the feeling that people's closets, either literally or metaphorically, will often contain a prosthesis they got that just it wasn't right. It might have been the absolute state-of-the-art prosthesis, but it wasn't what that person as a farmer needed. And that some people wind up thinking, you know what, I'm actually better with all the compensations and adjustments that I made having nothing here or with something about a lot more basic. And the idea that everybody, I mean, we're going to talk about whether everybody can afford, has access to the state of the art. That's a separate question. But there's also a question about what everybody needs. And I assume what everybody needs isn't always the most advanced thing. It's the thing that fits the thing they want to do.
That's right. Yeah. Not everybody is a terrific super athlete like Robert here. Not everybody wants a whiz-bang prosthesis that can do, you know, a Lamborghini. Not everyone should drive a Lamborghini, and not everyone should drive a Lamborghini. Some people just need something to be stable and to get you through. But everyone has a different set of needs, and it's up to the prosthetist to try to figure out what those needs are and then match them to the right prosthesis. But as Rose says, the options are limited. And as you allude, prosthetic disuse is rampant. Anywhere between 35% and 50% of upper limb amputees would rather go without than use the hand they've got. Even though it doesn't cost them anything, they'd rather put it in the closet and just use their what you would call residuum to stabilize and move on without it.
And I'm assuming that's for a bunch of different reasons. Like, once again, I can't remember where I read what, but Michael, I remember I did read about, for example, a farmer who was given a myoelectric arm, and he said, you know, geez, I work in the rain, I work in the – it's just this thing just doesn't work for me. You know, I'm really a lot better off either without the residuum, as you said, or with something a lot simpler. So there's sort of that. And then I guess there's a lot of other reasons why people would decide – toward disuse. Maybe you can say what those reasons are.
Sure. Probably the biggest factor is it doesn't work the way I want it to work, and therefore it's a heavy thing that doesn't do what I want it to do. Some people think it's not cosmetically appealing. For some people, it's not safe, and this is often overlooked. You know, you think it's trivial to give somebody a prosthetic foot, but the fact of the matter is if you let them walk down on the street and then a prosthetic foot is good for 99 out of 100 steps, that 100th step you're going to end up on the ground, and that's a very, very bad place to be. So if it's safer to go without it, then you're going to go without it.
Robert, have you had prostheses where you just said, can't have this thing?
Absolutely. When I was younger, I believe being uneducated because I felt like I was an alien in a sense. I didn't know many amputees. It was the 90s. We didn't have the outlets that we have now. So there were a lot of products that I wasn't happy with, a lot of feet that didn't give me the response that I needed. that I had to kind of learn the hard way in what I did like. And it kind of got me to where I am now, trial and error. So now I know exactly what product I like. I know exactly how to make my leg. I work for an O&P company, so I work on my own prosthetics. So it's a lot easier for me to determine that. And I see some companies, they might have relationships with certain manufacturers, and they kind of force on that product to a patient. And that's a lot of times where I see some patients who might put their prosthetic in the closet and not use it.
You must be in contact with people who are newly in need of prostheses. Well, how do you guide a new patient? What do you tell a new patient about how to get through that process?
My biggest advice to patients are two things. Amputees are afraid of falling, and their legs falling coming off. So once you can kind of get over those hurdles and kind of get that confidence and trust your leg, like we were saying earlier, making this leg a part of you, adjusting to it and understanding that this is your leg now and you have to live with it. So trust it and don't be afraid to fall and don't be afraid for it to fall off. And once you get through that and have that confidence, life becomes a little bit easier.
Do you think we, Robert, do you think that we kind of underestimate how hard this really is? In other words, I had this going into this show, kind of simplistic idea. Wow, we can do anything these days. We've got a Mars rover, so it's got to be relatively easy to solve some of these problems now that were, you know, really difficult at the end of the Civil War or something like that. We must have come so far. But I'm assuming as you deal all through your life with the realities of this, you see maybe what I didn't see.
Absolutely. I think that us as people, we all have hurdles, whether you're an amputee or not an amputee. I think it's just as far as the mental mind state of keeping a positive attitude. That's the one thing that we can control is our attitude. And that can kind of get us through it. Everything else is beyond us. So anyone goes through their day-to-day issues, just like amputees, but it's a positive mental attitude that gets us through that.
Rose, you know, I know that you sort of looked at the history of all this, and it really is just to come back to our original point here, I think it's a history that kind of has been misrepresented to us. Most of us have our images of this whole question probably from wars, car accidents, maybe something like the Boston Marathon bombing, right? And we know at the end of the Civil War, there were like 30,000 people needing some kind of, or amputees anyway, people potentially needing some kind of prosthetic. So what's the missing part of that story?
It's interesting. The way that I think especially sort of average people who maybe didn't encounter an amputee before are seeing it, you know, represented in on the news or in these sort of like in quote unquote inspiring stories that, you know, get sort of trotted out a lot of the time is that it is often veterans and it is often people who are then, you know, going on to do extreme sports or something like that. And that's great. And those people should absolutely do that. And, you know, I don't want to diminish any of their success and enjoyment of what they're doing. But I think a lot of people think of them because that's what they see. That's what, you know, they're shown. The other side of sort of the history is that there's been this long question and sort of this long insecurity that especially war brings, I think, in general to any you know, nation that goes to war is going to be ambivalent about it mostly. I mean, even if you think you're fighting the right fight, it's hard. Things are bad. You know, people come back injured. A lot of people die. And so especially after war, that's when you start to see a lot of messaging around prosthetics. And there's some really interesting history there in terms of what prosthetic designers were hoping to do for people. And especially because that was often tied up in ideas of masculinity and ideas of these soldiers who are coming back and they wanted to be able to regain their position at sort of the head of their household. You saw these really interesting ads for prosthetics and these interesting designs that really focused on sort of restoring a quote-unquote manliness that soldiers felt like they had lost because they had lost part of their body. Now, we don't really think of it as much that way anymore, but if you look at some of the ads and sort of the ways that people talked about prosthetics after wars, often it's like, what do men need to be able to do? They need to be able to smoke a cigarette and drive a car. And so those were the things that prosthetic designers really focused on when, you know, as we've talked about, like maybe not all of those men like really cared that much about those two things, but they were the things that symbolized, oh, now you're back and you are a man again in our culture. And thankfully, like, you know, we don't focus on that quite as much, but we do see some of those repercussions later on. You know, I've written a little bit about how often prosthetic manufacturers design for men first and women don't have, you know, feet or hands that fit them. Robert talked about how when he was a kid, a lot of things didn't work. Pediatric prosthetics, which is a field that's really hard to do because you need components that are really small and also because your, you know, consumer base is not very large. So you end up with a lot of designs for kids that don't quite work the way that they might need to. And so there's a lot of sort of residual leftover stuff from that focus on the war version of an amputee and sort of forgetting about some of the other people that have these same sorts of needs.
All right. Let me grab a call here from Carrie in Washington. Hi, Carrie in Spokane,
Hi,
Washington. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm really interested in your topic. Of course, not only am I a patient myself, it's funny you were talking about hooks, and I've grown up wearing different types of prostheses on my arm, and now at 44, I've gone back to wearing a hook. So like I've heard with your other guests, things come and go, and you try new technologies, and you back and forth, and different times in your life, high-tech stuff or cosmetic stuff is important, and then function. So, but the reason I'm calling is I run a program called AmPower. It's through Hanger Clinic, and it's a peer support network. And actually, Robert is part of our network. We met online in 2011 through our empoweringamputees.org site. But we're a nationwide peer mentoring program for new amputees and family members and care providers who are going through the process of recovery and rehabilitation.
Well, that sounds like a spectacular thing. And well, first of all, thank you very much for calling. Maybe you could just quickly say, because this is one of the things that really has fascinated me, just to kind of come back to it, reading Rose's work and just reading the notes for this show. That whole notion that you would go back and forth, that it wouldn't be this orderly progress, Carrie, where, you know, one day you had a hook, the next day you had sort of a hand where all four fingers were the same length. And, you know, I mean, that there just wouldn't be this kind of evolution towards the highest level of technology. You're describing it differently as fits and starts and going backwards. What makes you, you probably don't think of it as backwards, but going back to what seems right to you, what causes that? What would trigger that?
Well, I can speak to my own experience. I have grown up, like I said, wearing different prostheses. I was fit at 9 months with a cable-operated hook, which was very functional. But like Robert said, you know, I kind of felt like the outcast. I didn't know anyone else that had hooks. I just really wanted to blend in, and at 17, I was given the opportunity to switch to a myoelectric hand, and I went off to college wearing a hand, and no one noticed me, and it was fantastic, and it was wonderful, and I loved just blending in and looking like other people. So at that time in my life, using that high-tech myoelectric hand and not having the straps across my body was really a gift. But then, you know, as I moved in later into my life, the hand was super functional, and I love the myoelectric aspect of it, but I also love the fine motor application of a hook. So I wear a myoelectric hook, and my idea of, you know, blending in, that doesn't matter anymore to me. In fact, I have a black carbon fiber forearm that's covered in flat-back Swarovski crystals. So it's this dazzling, just sparkly black forearm, but it's more functional for me. Versus a hand. Visually, I can see around it, but I still have the myoelectric control. I've tried other hands, multi-articulating digits and that sort of thing. I love the compliant grasp. I think it's a wonderful move towards a more realistic hand. However, with all of those moving parts, there's a lot more things that I can break, and I'm really hard on my hand. It depends on your level of use and what you need, and that's why you just bounce around. When I'm out in my yard, I don't want a super high-tech something that, you know, is myoelectrically could potentially break down with the dirt and you know, hose and all of that when I'm working in my garden. So I want something rough and tumble. And that's why you just kind of have to be able to move around. And
well, thanks for
in the world of prosthetics.
Thanks for sharing that, Carrie. Michael, as you're listening to all of this, obviously the hand is something that you've been giving not just a lot of thought to, but putting a lot of work into. The hand is a really difficult puzzle to solve for a lot of reasons, but people are starting to talk about something called the Hartford hand. Tell us about the Hartford hand.
Oh, that's lovely. Yes, so the Hartford hand is attempting to be the world's very first fully customizable hand in terms of its morphology, meaning that it looks just like the hand that you want it to look like. So the hand will grow with the child as the child grows. Or if you know if you're getting it and applying it to an off-the-shelf post-market hand, that if you need the fingers to be thicker, you can dial the fingers out, make it thicker. If you need the palm to be thicker or wider, you can do that. And it has a very simple control paradigm, and it's the world's first fully customizable hand. I've got a nice legion of students who've dedicated their graduate careers to working on the Harvard hand, and I'm very proud of where the Harvard hand is at this time.
I mean, maybe just quickly, I need to go to a break here pretty quickly, but maybe, you know, I mean, reading about this, it sounds like prosthetic hands heretofore have often looked like sort of hands drawn by people who can't draw hands very well. If you can't draw hands very well, you draw all the fingers the same length, or that it's been very hard to get the kind of thing that you're talking about.
Exactly right. It doesn't exist. And as Rose alluded, there are some people who would really like to have a hand that looks like what they call the Terminator. You know, but there are some people who would really like just to have their hand look like a natural hand. And when you get a hand off the shelf where all four fingers are pulled from the same box and just kind of screwed on to the end terminal, and you've got four digits that look the same, it's not biomimetic, it's not biomimicry, it doesn't look good, doesn't feel good. This hand will look like the hand you want.
That's amazing. All right. We really do have to take a break right now. We'll come back. All of our guests are staying with us. We'll be adding yet another voice to the conversation after this. Michael Winninger just said to me, "You're really covering all the bases." I'm thinking, I'm such a fraud. Betsy Coughlin has totally gotten me ready for this show. She's done a great job of making sure I understand what I'm talking about, or at least I can be made to appear that I'm like a prosthetic host or something. You know, I can be made to appear like I'm actually doing what I'm supposed to be doing. All right, so we're talking about prosthetics, and we're talking about kind of the state of the technology, but also the one of the things that's really clear to me now is that, and it should be clear to anybody really, is that prosthetics are people, right? This is not something that is ever going to be separate from you. It's going to be part of a person, and every single person is different. Every single person has something that they particularly want to do or feel or be. They want to look a certain way, and we're just not all the same. So to that end, we thought it would be important to talk to a prosthetist. Michael McCauley is a certified prosthetist who runs a clinic in Nashville. Welcome to our discussion, first of all.
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're fine. So one thing that I've already figured out from the other Michael is that if I need prosthesis, I can't just walk in and you'll go into the back room and come back out with something my size and put it on me and a couple of weeks of physical therapy and off I go. This is just a much more complicated process of device and human interacting and getting together. So tell us what a prosthetist does. I know that's a four-hour answer, but give us the 90-second answer.
Well, basically, you know, we never know what to expect when a patient comes into our clinic and what kind of, you know, psychology is involved with that. That patient walks in, and you're exactly right. Sometimes they say, "Hey, where's the wall?" And I'm like, "Well, what wall are you talking about?" And they're saying, "Well, the wall where I pick out my next leg." And so that's where the process comes in, that we have to educate the patient and explain to them that this is a custom device. There's many different types of prosthetic feet, many different types of prosthetic knees, socket designs, interfaces. It's very, very custom to the patient, and I think that's the most important thing, and that's where we come in. So we're more like artists and engineers more than anything.
What are, like, you know, Robert, who's here, is a very, very sophisticated customer, consumer of prostheses. He works with them now, knows a lot about them. But the average person walking in for their first prosthetic fitting or interface, they're not going to know those kinds of things. So what are some questions, Michael McCauley, that you would ask me right away if I came in cold?
Well, I want to find out about you and what's your life been like up to now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've gone through a traumatic scenario of losing your leg or your arm. But what did you do beforehand? What do you want to do now? So that's kind of the biggest thing, is I want to learn about you. Getting a prosthetic leg when you come into my practice is we have to build a relationship with one another. It's not a patient's not going to come in, we're going to work together for a week or two, and then I'm never going to see them again. So it's about building that relationship and finding out what that person needs and how can I get them back to their life.
Robert, maybe you can give the sort of the patient's perspective. What's the what for you as a patient is the relationship that's important between you and prosthetist?
I can agree. Me and my prosthetist, I think you need to have a personal relationship because, again, it is custom. So I can agree. I need to be able to, you know, speak to my prosthetist, let them know, hey, I need an alignment change. You know, I'm having some socket issues. You know, I need some things maybe shaved out. I need, you know, some gel padding at the bottom of my prosthesis. So being able to not just give whatever is taken to me, that's what I try to let other patients know. Be very specific in what's going on with your limb. Let your prosthetist know so they can make those adjustments.
But Michael McCauley, I'm also thinking that, okay, so Robert's been dealing with this for pretty much his entire life. People who are coming in new, maybe they don't exactly know what they want. I mean, maybe they think they know what they want. Maybe I would imagine that people come back to you after 6 months, a year, 2 years and say, you know what? There's something else that I really need from this. Can you give it to me? Can you describe maybe how people's attitudes towards the prosthesis they have or need might change?
Yeah, absolutely. In the beginning, you know, walking on a prosthetic for the first time is not an easy task. Some people pick it up better than others, but things advance. So if I give a prosthetic leg to an individual, you know, in say their first week using it, they're going to be a little more slower, a little more stable and cautious. So that's going to change. So as they get used to these, and they might be in a walker at first, and then they might go to a four-point cane and then to a cane and advance out of that to where they start to feel more confident in public. So as they come back for follow-ups, which, again, it's a relationship, so I try to see my patients every 3 months, but things change. So, hey, you know, last time I saw you, I was walking this way. Well, now I feel like I'm being held back. Well, that tells me, okay, then I can slowly give you a little more freedom and say that foot and to allow you to walk a little faster. Or just like you mentioned, you know, with alignment changes. All those things are going to advance, and especially when they come back to get a new prosthetic, say from wear and tear or whatnot, then those advancements that have come out since then are going to be advantageous for them now that they've conquered the first fear of getting used to that prosthetic leg.
Michael McCauley, I've got the research guy, the other Michael, Michael Wininger here, assistant professor from University of Hartford, master's program in prosthetics and orthotics. So you running a clinic in Nashville, you have things that I suppose that you hope you will see someday, things that you hope will come into your clinic that you hope get developed on the research end of things. Can you mention maybe what one or two of those things would be?
Gosh, I mean, every year things are changing and things are getting more and more exciting. Yes, I mean, there's so many things, and you can narrow this down to just knees or feet or, you know, elbows and hands, whatever you want to talk about. But I think that Mike Wininger said it right when we're going towards more cosmetic things. You know, we can get quite a bit of function back for the amputee right now, but cosmetically, we're still not completely there. So I think that's something I want to see more of. And then I think the interface between the amputee and the prosthetic, I think, can still get much, much better. Right now, we rely on ground reaction forces and gravity to make these prosthetics work the way they do. But now with myoelectricity coming in for upper extremity patients, I think we can also see that coming into lower extremity patients and them actually firing their quads and hamstrings to activate that prosthetic knee.
Let me just grab a quick call from Tara in West Hartford. Hi, Tara.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You're on the air.
So I am coming up on my one-year anniversary, November 19th, and I am more active than I have been the last couple months than I had been the previous 15 years. Mine was an elective amputation below the knee, and I just wanted to share some happy news.
When you say an elective amputation, I think that might be a confusing term for people. What do you mean?
Yes. So I was born with a birth defect called arthrogryposis. I've had tons of surgeries on my legs, and my left ankle had been fused probably about 20 years ago and was very painful the last 15. And it was a joke between my husband and I, why can't we just cut this thing off? Because it was really, really slowing me down due to pain. So we went through, did a ton of research, had a peer visitor from the Amputee Coalition come out, meet me and my family, and we made the decision to go ahead and have a below-the-knee amputation.
Since she just did call, first of all, Tara, thank you so much for that call and for sharing that story. Actually, Tara, are you still there? I just want to ask you one more question.
Yes.
So one thing Rose said earlier, and I'm going to have Rose amplify it a little bit in just a second, but Rose said that men and male problems for a long time seem to drive this industry, that the things that men thought about and wanted drove not only the industry, the science, the medicine, the developments, and that women's issues came second. Is there any way that that's true for you, that you had a set of concerns that might be different from a man's?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for your call. Rose, and maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. When you said that before, well, I know you're talking about drive a car, smoke a cigarette. Is it more than that?
Yeah, so a lot of women that I've talked to, and this is obviously not the case for everyone. As we've said, you know, every amputee is different and every person is differently sized. But a lot of the women that I spoke to had trouble finding both cosmetically things that they liked. So for a long time, there was a foot that a lot of people sort of jokingly referred to as the Sasquatch foot, a lot of women referred to, because it was this big rubber foot that just like doesn't look very feminine, is often much larger than their other foot. Some women who have, who have a below the knee or sort of have a lower body amputation, they want to be able to like wear cute shoes, and they want to be able to like walk around and not sort of shove this big rubber foot. They would have to buy two different size shoes, so two pairs of shoes, but like one for their other foot and one for their sort of Sasquatch foot. And it wasn't until relatively recently, in the grand scheme of things, that like companies started making smaller feet. Companies started making feet that you could adjust the angle of the ankle on, so you could wear heels if you wanted to. And there are examples with hands too. And it's a sort of a technical challenge to make things smaller. We talked a little bit about pediatric prosthetics, and that's the case as well. But anytime you're trying to make something smaller, it's a little bit harder. And so women who have small hands often feel like the hand, their prosthetic hand, just like is too big. That's changing really rapidly, and a lot of places are working on that. And I think, you know, the Hartford hand is a good example of it actually can come smaller for a lot of people, and that's great. But a lot of the women I talked to said things like that, just cosmetically, but also functionally. For knees, especially for athletes, women who want to be athletes, sometimes the knee joint is they can't get enough of their own body weight on it to move it. So in order to, and Robert can talk a little bit about, or I guess he doesn't have a knee, right? Is that right, Robert?
Yeah, I'm below the knee.
Sorry.
But that's okay.
but it's in order to bend the knee on a lot of designs, you actually have to put your body weight on it. And some women find that for the active knees, they don't have enough body weight to put on it to bend it the way they want to bend it. So there are things like that. And that is one place I think that, you know, it's changing really quickly. And a lot of companies are realizing that, you know, these problems exist. I think that this is news to them. My favorite little side anecdote from that was that one of the first companies that introduced an ankle that you could adjust the angle on to be able to wear heels, they started noticing that they were getting a ton of orders from Texas, and they couldn't figure out why. And they realized that actually men were ordering it because they wanted to wear cowboy boots and they had that heel on them. So it's sort of like unexpected. Like, people want this that you might not expect.
Michael McCauley, I know that you have to go. I don't know whether you, in 60 seconds before you go, wanted to say anything about that sort of that gender difference, what men need versus what women need.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a concern, and I think it's been addressed more and more in the past, I'd say, you know, 5 years. But, like, just for the foot shells, you know, like, we have prosthetic feet, and there's a foot shell that goes over top of that carbon. Those foot shells are basically one size. You know, we pick the right size for the patient, but there's no male or female. I have several female patients that say, wow, these are man toes, and, you know, they're too big. And so I do see that, and I think in regards to her comment about the prosthetic knees, most prosthetic knees that are coming out now are coming with that adjustability that we can decrease the amount of weight needed to put into the prosthetic knee to allow it to go into that flexion or bending moment. So I recently just had a patient that we gave a microprocessor hand to that was just too large. It worked for her fine, and she could do everything with it, but when she had her prosthetic hand next to her real hand, it was just a sizable difference. And even though she was functional with it, it's something that it didn't make her happy. So we had to go a different route and try to find a manufacturer that could give us a hand that was a little more her size. So I completely agree. I think the industry is moving in the right direction with that. So we'll see where it goes.
All right. We're going to take a quick break here. Thank you very much to Michael McCauley. But when we come back, all of our other guests will still be here. We've got your phone calls and tweets as well.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Dan Schultz and Sarah Flaherty. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Cyril Richard. For show pages and news, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the nose decorates its own Starbucks cups. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, honestly, I'm not 100% sure what we're doing on the nose tomorrow, but I will figure it out. Rose Eveleth is with us. She is a science journalist and columnist for BBC Future, currently produces and hosts Meanwhile in the Future, a podcast for Gizmodo. Michael Wininger in studio with us, assistant professor, University of Hartford's master's programs in prosthetics and orthotics. And Robert Rodriguez is an amputee, plays basketball for AMP, AMP1, I think we say, Freedom Innovation's first stand-up basketball team. Robert, I'm going to go to you first. One of the things we really haven't talked about here is money. These things sound very complicated, state-of-the-art prosthetics, and we know that our healthcare system is spotty, has big gaps in it. So tell us a little bit about sort of the affordability or who gets these things, or does insurance automatically cover all of them? I'm guessing the answer to that is no.
So, usually as amputees, you're leveled by K-level, meaning K1, not really moving as much. K2 is ambulating within your home, from the bed to the bathroom. K3 means you're kind of walking out in the street, and K4 is something like myself, which would be playing sports and high activity things. But it is a process because insurance companies are denying products for K3 and K4 patients. They're kind of almost saying, it's a luxury to have a prosthetic limb. That's actually it's been a big, big promotion that we've been pushing for the last few months. There's been a petition out with 110,000 signatures now that Medicare is reconsidering giving the best products to the best patients. This is kind of what Mike was saying before. Not everyone should drive a Lamborghini, but we should have a choice, especially if you can afford it. So, but insurance companies have made it very difficult for some patients to get the correct product that they need and would prefer to give them, a wheelchair or crutches.
Yeah, Michael, did you want to contribute to that conversation?
Sure. The package that Robert described has lots of very clever machinations in it. So, for instance, Robert is a K4. Now, Robert, I'll ask you. I have no idea, so I'm asking, as a real inquisitive, have you ever used a cane or a walker in any of your rehab before?
I have not.
Okay, so any K4 who's ever used a cane or a walker at any time, any ancillary aid would be considered a K3 mm-hmm. in terms of this new package, which has not been passed but is proposed, and therefore would not be eligible for a K4-level prosthesis. And they could have an auditor come in and analyze Robert's gait, and if they find any gait abnormalities, then they can deny funding. Now, and I can guarantee you I can go on the street onto Asylum Avenue right here and take anybody and find a gait abnormality immediately. What normal gait is something that's ill-defined and impossible to measure.
And so, Rose, I mean, we talked before about how some people wind up rejecting or not using whatever kind of prosthesis they get. But this is the other part of the story. Not everybody gets a Lamborghini. Not everybody can afford or get access to a Lamborghini. Some of the people who are sporting the equivalent of fleet cars are doing so for that reason, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think in particular, the ways in which prosthetics have improved that we talked about a little bit have not really been reflected in the ways in which our healthcare system thinks about prosthetics. So in a lot of the ways that when you read sort of Medicare documents or the ways that healthcare providers think about prosthetics, they often don't really match with the way that prosthetics actually work now. And so you get these sort of weird mismatches. And one of the problems that, I have not experienced, but I'm sure many people that Robert knows and Michael knows have experienced, is that there's just this miscommunication or this mismatch between what amputees actually need and sort of what the reality of their situations are and sort of the way that that's coded in the healthcare system. So particularly with Medicare, where there's a lot of auditing right now, for a while there was a big concern amongst lawmakers about fraud within prosthetics. People thought that people were getting things they didn't need, or were doctors were charging for things that maybe they weren't actually giving, and they kind of tried to crack down. But that crackdown has actually had a huge impact on particularly smaller prosthetists, people who aren't affiliated with big companies, people who are just sort of trying to provide care for people. And many times they're now having to make a choice between whether they want to give the person the thing they need, you know, the foot or the hand that they actually need and that is going to give them the best performance, or whether or not they want to get paid for that item, because the way that the auditing is working is really kind of crazy. So that's never a good choice to have to make. You never want healthcare providers to be in that position to say, like, oh, well, I could get my money, or I could give you something that isn't as good as what you deserve or what you want. So that's not a good place to be. And so I think that there's in the coming years, we'll have to figure out, like, how to make the rules and regulations fit with what the reality is for people who are trying to live their best lives and do their best and get the function that they want, whether that's basketball or whatever else it is.
We've only got about 3 minutes left. If we had more time, one thing I'd get Rose to talk about, and maybe everybody else too, one of the ways in which this expense has been addressed is through the world of, Rose mentioned before, just people hacking their own problems, but also using 3D printers to try to develop their own stuff. And if we have time right at the end, maybe we can talk about that a little bit. But Michael Wininger, 10 years from now, if I bring you back in here, what are we going to be talking about that's different? What's the next frontier here?
I hope you will have me back in 10 years. I'd love to. Prosthetic control. Yeah. There's a big push in modern research to get better control. So the human hand has somewhere between 25 and 30 degrees of freedom. At best, we can control maybe three at one time. Usually most hands, the most sophisticated $50,000 hand that you can possibly purchase, can only control 1 or 2 degrees of freedom at a time. So in 10 years, I hope that we'll have better control over more degrees of freedom.
And when you say control, what do you mean?
So you know, the mechanical engineers out there are so wonderful. They can make a hand that is so sophisticated that it can do all the things you can do. Bend your finger, adduct, abduct. You can bend the wrist. You can do everything. You can have 30 different grasps. The problem is that I couldn't extract what we call neuromuscular volition. I can't extract the signals from your brain or your peripheral anatomy to control those degrees of freedom. At best, 1 or 2 at a time. A simple open, close, or, you know, bend and relax. That's it.
And so if I understand the problem, then, and some of the reading that I did suggested, one of the questions is, where do you want to put that control? Do you want to, like, go into the motor cortex of the brain and put that control there? A lot of people probably don't want, like, I got enough problems without you going into my brain. Another thing might be some kind of cap, some kind of hat that you wear where the signals from the motor cortex get to the hat and then get to the prosthesis?
Oh, that's an exquisite question. You know, in the brain is the best place to go, but the problem is it's such a small area and it's so diffuse. You know, if you want to have I want to consciously reach over and shake your hand, I have to have the prefrontal cortex, the pre-supplemental motor area, the motor cortex, central cortex, parietal lobe, occipital lobe. It's all working as one loop. It's impossible. It's like a moving target. Can't catch it.
So that sounds like stay out of the brain.
It's no better. You know, if you think it's bad in the brain, it's no better in the peripheral anatomy, because once you leave the brain, you're down to a single telephone wire. You know, it's just the one nerve that's going to the arm, and then you're missing quite a lot.
All right. I can't ask another question because I only got 90 seconds left. I think what I'm going to do instead is say, this is a really fascinating topic and you should read some of the other reporting that's been done by Rose Everlith and other people, particularly on this whole question. I mean, it's interesting stuff. I don't know how wide the applications are, but this whole idea of people using 3D printing technology and printing instead of, you know, creating instead of, you know, the $1,000 limb, the $100 limb. There's a lot more to read and think about here, so keep it going. Thanks very much to Rose Everlith, as we said. Host Meanwhile in the Future, a podcast for Gizmodo, to Robert Rodriguez, amputee, activist, basketball star, many other things as well. Michael Wininger is assistant professor at the University of Hartford's Master Program in Prosthetics and Orthotics. Who even knew we had this in our backyard? Special thanks to Betsy Kaplan for pulling this whole thing together. We'll be back tomorrow with the nose. They actually do prosthetic noses. I read about that too.